Chris Metcalf, give me a name.
James Brown.
Welcome to Give Me a Name, where a guest presents me, Ben Kirschenbaum, with a dead historical figure they find interesting, and we discuss. I hope this podcast helps some of you forget about the wildfires for an hour. Now, let's talk about Mr. Dynamite. So I'm here with the hardest working man in comedy, Mr. Chris Metcalf. How you doing?
I'm doing good, my young man.
You're not doing it yet.
I just start doing strung out James Brown the whole time. I'm doing good, man. Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm very excited to do this.
Let's do it. James Brown, the hardest working man in show business.
One of my favorite artists of all time.
Mr. Dynamite.
I didn't know he was the hardest working man until we watched that doc.
He's got one of the long, it almost is like the introduction to Apollo Creed and Rocky, like the longest list of nicknames.
Yes.
Yes. That I can think of.
Yeah, because he's the king of soul.
Yeah. Soul Brother number one.
Soul Brother number one.
Lest we forget, Soul Brother number one. Hardest working man in show business, Godfather of Soul, Mr. Dynamite, Soul Brother number one. Yeah, I mean, it just kind of goes on, and he deserves the titles.
I mean, come on. He's like a Michael Jordan of fucking musicians. The guy was like, we must be perfect at all costs.
Yeah, a complete perfectionist.
There's a great quote from a band that I hate. I hate the band Phish, but I remember I watched some documentary with them a long time ago, and they just got off doing this massive show, and they just killed. And whatever the guy's Trey, whatever the lead singer of fucking Phish is, he turns to the band and goes, guys, we just played as good as James Brown's band on their worst day. Like that's how like good that's they good. Were, where they're yeah. like, that's... The yeah, level.
I like that. That reminds me of the JFK quote where he's like in, I think, the presidential dining room or whatever, having dinner with like the smartest people in the world, Nobel Prize winners or whatever. And he's like, this is the smartest group of people to be at this table since Thomas Jefferson dined alone.
Fuck yeah.
So James Brown, James Joseph Brown, and apparently they screwed it up that it was supposed to be Joseph James Brown, was born on May 2nd, 1933 in Barnwell, South Carolina. I don't know if it was the documentary that we both watched, Mr. Dynamite, but I think there was another documentary that said, or maybe it was a podcast that was like, legend had it that he was a stillborn baby, but he worked so hard. That he was able to survive.
Dude, that is like some South, like deep South, like black voodoo magic fucking belief type of shit.
I don't know if that was actually believed by people, but it's such a funny part of the legend.
He was born a stillborn baby. He worked so hard. He became alive. That's wild.
And grew up in complete poverty. I mean, just like the worst upbringing that you could possibly have.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know at what age, I don't remember what age his parents left him, but like his parents left him at like six or something, and he was raised in like a whorehouse.
His aunt ran a brothel, and he's there for a while. There's a story of him being sent home from school because his clothes were too dirty.
Right.
His dad was a laborer, took like the sap to make turpentine. And James Brown had like a lot of odd jobs when he's growing up. He's picking cotton. He's shining shoes.
Right.
And eventually goes to jail when he's 16 years old.
Yeah.
Car theft. Stealing cars.
That whole era of like, because what years were that? What year was he
born? So born in 33 and he goes to jail in 49.
So that whole time period, you have to like... So, like, I'm really into blues music, and I love specifically Delta blues, like John Lee Hooker and who sings Manish Boy? Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
Like, all those guys. And what's so fascinating about that music, which, I mean, this applies to him, too, is, like, they're coming out of, not that long ago, slaves being, like, or like, the civil rights and all the slaves. So now you have all these plantations. And you have these huge communities of black people like living on land that's owned by somebody else, but they're like getting, do you know that some of these places had their own currency? Mm. So yeah. You have like your own city And like all this music is happening, these whole cities and all these jobs. So it's hard to even know what's real and not real because it's not being documented at all.
Right.
And that's why a lot of it, I feel like, lives in the here, in the lore. There's a lot of lore behind all these guys.
Absolutely.
From you, these times, the black artists of these times, there's like lore around all of them.
Not much is being recorded.
No.
And yeah, it's a completely separate. And when James Brown starts performing in the 50s, when he gets out of jail, he's doing what's called the Chitlin' Circuit.
Yes.
Which is basically, I mean, he's just performing for black audiences at first.
Right.
And it's, again, it's like its own community. It's its own totally separate realm.
Yeah.
And the idea of being a crossover artist in either direction
is wild.
Yeah.
Is wild. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because, yeah, I don't know. I guess, I don't know if there were white artists doing the Chitlin' Circuit, but yeah, the crossover from being a black artist to a white audience was like, every once in a while, one guy would get like a track.
And a lot of the famous black artists who did tended to be much lighter skinned than James Brown.
Yes.
Had a certain, you know, you think in the 50s, Smokey Robinson and Jackie Wilson. They, you know, James Brown is a very dark-skinned black guy. He's like 5'6". He doesn't look the part.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he's not like conventionally like attractive. He looks like a caricature.
Yeah,
like he's short. He's got a big head. He's got the big like smile. Like he looks like a caricature of himself. Like he looks like a cartoon.
And then there's the hair.
With the hair. But that was It seemed like everyone was kind of doing that.
Yes. And that becomes important because his hair is that kind of coif that he's famous for becomes important because it's very much like, you know, making your hair, quote unquote, white.
Yes.
And when he starts in the late 60s, when it starts getting more involved with the civil rights movement, he will rock the
I can't wait to talk about that. When him, when he talks to Bootsy about how he's not cool anymore.
So he was supposed to go to jail or, well, juvie for like 8 to 16 years. He gets out after 3, and he befriends a guy named Bobby Byrd, who is a very important person in his life, and his family is very important in his life because they, some say that they like helped him get out of jail, but they kind of take him in, and Byrd is the one that brings him into his band, which will eventually be the Famous Flames. And the Famous Flames is the band that Brown really gets started with in the 50s.
Right.
And his first big hit is Please, Please, Please.
Yeah.
Which the record producers are like, or one in particular was like, no way. Like, we're
You just keep saying please over again.
Yeah. He's like,
you just keep literally the whole song.
Yeah.
And then at the end, he's just like, will you leave me? You know, it's just like, he only says a few words, different words in the song, and it's a lot of repetitive.
Yeah, exactly. It's not, I mean, I don't blame any record producer who's looking to have a, you know, big time artist, crossover artist for being like, no way. Like this is, I mean, it takes a amazing amount of foresight to be able to tell that this, that he would be a huge, huge success.
See, maybe this is like hard.
For the music part, not the entertaining, you know, dancing and all that stuff.
Well, wait, but you're talking about from the perspective of a record like label owner.
Yeah.
And you hear this song, like to me, I feel like if I hear it and I'm like, this song is great, regardless of how many different words you're using.
Right.
I don't know. In my mind, I'm like, why would that?
Just because I don't think there's anything like it before that works. I feel like the way a record producer works is not as, it's very much just like, okay, you know, the Beatles work, therefore the Kinks are going to work. That makes sense. You know, like.
Right.
I guess it takes like, I guess it's not true if you're actually talented at your job.
But do you think though, that like due to collective memory and that we're in 2023 and obviously Please, Please, Please is a classic, that we all, it's hard for us to see it any other way?
Yeah, for sure.
Like I'm trying to think of a song that if I heard it, I'd be like, no. And then it becomes
Bohemian Rhapsody, something like that.
Maybe. I guess I was a little like, whoa, what is this?
Yeah.
But I wasn't like, turn this off.
Oh, no, I meant like at the time.
The time of when it came out.
No, not when you're listening to it for the first time in the 90s being like,
yeah.
I think they're going to make
Wayne's World.
It.
on Wayne's World. Where I'm like, this is awesome. Yeah.
Try Me is the other big early hit. And he, just to talk about him as an entertainer, you could look up videos of him in the 50s and 60s. It's Michael Jackson to me is the easiest comparison in terms of just as an entertainer, not the music, but as an entertainer. The dancing is like insane.
It's fucking nuts, dude. Yeah. And you watch him and then you start just seeing all the other pop artists that have come after him, including Elvis. Yeah. We're just like everyone bit off of him.
Yeah, it's impossible not to. And so Mick Jagger's the most famous example. So there's the thing called the Tammy Show, which was filmed of like all the biggest artists, both white and black,
yeah,
in 64, I think. And James Brown wants to close. And it's like the Beach Boys and the Rolling Stones and like all these. And he wants to close the show and he doesn't. The Rolling Stones do. The story, so the, again, going back to lore, like the story goes that Mick Jagger had to follow his one of his heroes, James Brown.
Because when the show is presented, it's presented as this like hour-long special at the time. And when it comes out, it's already pre-recorded. So when you see it, it just seems like there's a live audience and one band is coming on after the other. Bang, 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 bang. So if you watch it, yeah, it just seems like James Brown just went up, murdered, and now the Rolling Stones have to like follow that.
And it's the Rolling Stones in particular because Jagger is clearly doing a James Brown when he performs, when he dances, but it's, you know, 1/10 of what Brown is doing. Right. So it's just so, I mean, it's like if a comic follows another comic and they're not only, and they're doing the same bits, but it's just not as good, or same style, but not as good.
But what I also found funny about that story, though, was that in the interviews in Dynamite, and I think we should maybe give the listeners like some context to like how James Brown was as a person. Because if you remember in the doc, they're interviewing Jagger and he's like, yeah, well, what the people don't know at home when they're watching it, and what James, he's like, what I don't think James realized was that there's like an hour to 2 hours between each set. And they bring in a full new audience.
So it's not really even
the same audience. Like, the audience that James Brown's performing for is completely different than the Rolling Stones. But despite that, remember Jagger says that after James Brown murdered, he walks over to Jagger and is like, good luck following that. He's like always vying for like one. Like number one.
Oh, he's competitive as hell. Yeah, no doubt about it.
Yes.
And going back to the perfectionist thing, so there are like so many stories of James Brown in terms of he saw himself almost first and foremost, I feel like, as a band leader. And as time goes on, these bands get so elaborate. I mean, there's so many. He's leading an orchestra.
Right.
Tons of people, you know, definitely brass instruments, but also drums.
Two drums?
Yeah, two drums.
Two fucking drums.
But he's like, gives them shit or will fire them or fine them if they don't wear the right thing, if they don't, you know, if they something imperfect about their performance, whatever it is. He sounds like a nightmare to work with. And it makes sense that a lot of members of his band later on just totally quit and he has to start from nothing over and over again.
But the paradox with all of it, though, is that they all said at some point that if it wasn't for playing in his band, that they wouldn't be as good of musicians as they are today.
Right. And we should say that the documentary that both of us were watching, Mr. Dynamite, is made after James Brown died. So he's not interviewed, but a lot of his former bandmates are.
Yes.
Probably most famously Pee Wee Ellis.
Pee Wee Ellis, Maceo, and Fred. Because I only know, say, Maceo and Fred, because those are the two names, as someone who listens to a lot of James Brown. I don't think a song goes by in certain years of James Brown where he's not like, Fred, or saying, Maceo, come on, Maceo. Like, he says Fred and Maceo all the time.
Right, and he's
calling them out to do horn and drum solos.
He is one of the pioneers, and they talk about that in the documentary, of like, you sort of see behind the curtain while he's in the studio when he's doing songs, even at the end of one of the songs where he's just like, you hear him say to the producer, I presume, being like, all right, cut it, cut right. and they're like, yeah, include that in the recording. It's like, what?
Yeah. It's crazy. Well, there's some albums, like, I am so into James Brown's music. Like, he has, his discography is, like, insane, like you said. But then if you look, he has some albums where it's just have a funky good time, and then it's, like, an EP, and it's, like, seven tracks, and each track is, like, 9 minutes or more long, and it's just them playing funky good time for 45 minutes.
Right.
And like different slight iterations of it. And that's just an album so that he would put out.
So probably his most famous album, 1963, Live at the Apollo.
Which is, yeah, we should rewind because these are two different genres of James Brown.
Okay, yeah.
Because old James Brown is, please, 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 like that doo-wop, like doot, 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 doot. It's more of that ilk.
Also kind of ballads, like pretty, yeah, slower.
Try me. Yeah, it's all those early, he's doing, that was the music of that time, like that rock and roll kind of-ish. But then it's later that he's doing that other stuff.
So Live at the Apollo, also, you know, totally bold move where a lot of people say don't do it because it's a live recording. You don't actually have it in the studio.
Right.
And it ends up becoming a huge success right away, particularly among black audiences. I think it was Questlove in the documentary. He was like, there was not a black household that did not have a copy of the vinyl of Live at the Apollo.
Yeah. And going back to the Chitlin' Circuit thing, it all happened because the Chitlin' Circuit would end at the Apollo. That's what they said. The Chitlin' Circuit was you do the South, you do the Midwest, you do all these places, and then you end your tour at the Apollo to show everybody what you've been working on.
That was, yeah, that was the goal. That's the special.
Right. And then so when he did that, he murdered the Apollo.
And the Apollo still, I mean, I think that's the name you associate with the Apollo more than any other artist, right?
What, James Brown?
Yeah.
With music. Yeah, I can't think of any other musicians that's like,
yeah,
at the Apollo. I know there's like some comedian stuff, but that's a different.
Yeah, different thing.
Yeah.
The other thing that we should mention in the early 60s is, so Brown, we're complimenting him and saying that he's the greatest, you know, thing ever. And as a musician and as a performer and, you know, band leader, all that stuff, he is. The beginning of his trouble with the law, other than being stealing cars and being put in prison at 16, is one story where it's at an Otis Redding performance. There's some musical rival that he's up against, and there's like a shootout, essentially, where a bunch of people were hurt. Also, he gets married for the first time, and his history of domestic violence is
smacking everybody.
It's rough. And I mean, accusation after accusation after accusation. Yeah. Ends up being married four times. There's debate about the fourth wife because she was married to a guy from Bangladesh. That became a whole legal trouble thing. But it's you know, wrong to not talk about James Brown for an hour without mentioning that the guy had, you know, he was not a perfect human being.
I feel like it's kind of like the age-old tale. I mean, it's like Jordan's a little bit like that, where you know, they talk about in the doc, and I watched something else on YouTube about him, that, I mean, the guy didn't have like a lot of friends.
You're talking about
James Brown.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't have a lot of friends, but like, he's like Jordan, that it's just like
Jordan.
Michael Jordan.
Oh, Michael Jordan. Yeah.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
Just because like Michael Jordan, he's got, there's that dark side to him where it's like this competitiveness that supersedes all else.
Right.
And it's that kind of like the end justifies the means. Not that he cheated or anything, but it's just like, I'm going to go all in, and there are no excuses, which I think is the crux of James Brown, because he wants to be number one, not even just amongst blacks, amongst everybody. He wants to be number one. He wanted to close over Rolling Stones, right? And I think what's interesting is they don't say this in the doc, but I thought about this, right? It's like anytime anybody could or would want to complain or did complain to James Brown, I bet you all he did all the time was just like, I was raised in a whole house. I was a stillborn baby who worked myself. Like, you have nothing to top him. So he's like, I don't want to hear excuses.
Going back to his childhood, his mom leaves the family when he's four. She leaves for New York. I think actually she leaves because the dad was abusive. So that, you know, plants the seed for that, you know, of course. One person that he became a father figure to somewhat randomly is Al Sharpton. And Sharpton said to James Brown something about how his father left him at an early age. And James Brown's response was like, my father and my mother left. Like there there is that competitiveness with tragedy even.
Yes.
That that you see, you know, based on the stories that people tell,
right? And even just the level, even and you touched on it, and we can get into it more later when it's appropriate. But like the level of perfection that he held everybody around him to,
yeah.
But then the flip side to all of it, he wasn't paying them all the time. He's hitting his wives. He's like full on narcissist. Everything. It's just it's like he put all his eggs in this one basket, and he was. Superior, supreme.
Yeah.
One of the greatest musicians of all time, or singers of all time, whatever you want to call them. But at the cost of like domestic violence, drug abuse, fucked up, you know, all this fucked up shit.
So in terms of, let's talk music first, and then we could talk more about, well, not only his like personal life, but also the civil rights and kind of like him as a larger
figure.
Yeah, that
was crazy. Yeah, yeah.
But 1965, Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. Which is one of the more influential songs ever.
And that horn opening.
Dude. And I think that this song, I mean, along with others, is kind of seen as the first funk song. I mean,
was it Papa's Got a Brand New Bag? Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. I think they said in the doc, a cold sweat.
And then a cold sweat.
This is a cold sweat.
And that one comes out a couple years later.
Yeah, and I think they said that is
like truly
what debated. I guess some would debate, but for a lot of people, is the first funk song.
And he's seen as, I mean, funk is a whole genre of music, and we can get into kind of what defines it and stuff. The thing that they keep saying in the documentary is like the focus on the one beat, like immediately.
Yeah, this changing of the timing and the. Playing the drums and like, I don't know, I'm not a fucking musician.
Yeah, but
the way
no,
they
fair,
were playing
too,
the
yeah.
drums and they, it was like a shit, they just did like an inverse of something that was already common in music and was seen by a lot of people as like, amongst musicians, like, why are they doing that? You don't do that.
Yeah, but and there's a certain like syncopation where it's, yeah, things are like out, not out of order, but like disturbed at like certain moments within the song. And it's noticeable. I mean, it is noticeable that it's different from the R&B that influenced it and the blues and rock and roll and all this stuff. And then its influence on other things is hard to even put into words. I mean, definitely hip hop.
Oh, well, he's the most, I don't know if this is still true today, but also people don't sample the way they used to, but I'm pretty sure James Brown is cited as the most sampled artist of all time in hip hop.
Right.
Like hands down. I mean, if you listen to any boom bap style hip hop from the 90s. I mean, it is an orgy of fucking James Brown samples.
And disco, which is interesting because disco, when the disco age really comes in, that's sort of his downfall a little bit because I guess like people say like disco is almost like a more basic form of the kind of stuff that he was doing.
I mean, yeah, disco's pretty... I feel like disco, we could all agree, is like the trashiest of the genres of music. Fun!
I like how you looked at me like I was about to
it's
get
offended. It's fun! You're like, oh no, disco... I didn't say that it's not fun and that there are some disco songs I enjoy, but as a genre, it's not like, you know.
I just take off my sweatshirt and it's Saturday Night Fever shirt. Under- What did you say? No, of course. But it's just interesting to me that he almost like plants the seed to what would almost top him in the charts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was such an OG. I mean, he's like a fucking Richard Pryor of didn't invent funk, but not that like he was like, I'm going to invent funk, but like it just happened. But I don't know. He did something that nobody else did and then everybody saw it. And then whether they knew it or not, we're just taking it.
Sure. Yeah, so a string of hits in the 60s. It's also at this time that you got I Got You, which is maybe his most famous song. Papa's Got a Brand New Bag, and I feel like an I Got You, I Feel Good, maybe the two most recognizable.
Oh, I Got You is...
I Feel Good.
Oh, that's what that song's called?
It's called I Got You, which is, yeah, you always think it's I Feel Good. But
oh, interesting.
I Got You.
Yeah, okay. It's driving me nuts that we're talking about these songs and we can't hear them.
I know, it's so annoying. And now, so
I hold you in my arms, you know it will do no harm.
It's just as good. We get, I end up getting sued for your version. Get sued, or it's just like, but it's a compliment, right? They're just like, he did such a, I swear to God, I thought that you were playing a James Brown recording.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of, I mean, he's got so many recognizable songs, but this era of the mid-60s might have done some of the ones that ended up standing the test of time the most in terms of just the songs themselves, not necessarily the influence.
Right. Well, his later stuff, I feel like, because we're getting into the civil rights movement, and this is where, obviously, the country's making a shift and a lot of pivotal things in our country happen, but also, this is also where, around the time where a chapter of his musical style is sort of not coming to a close, but he revamps himself.
Yeah, and it is so interesting how it parallels the change in the civil rights movement, how you're developed, you know, it's going into Black Power movement, Black Panthers eventually, and yeah, he's changing as that's changing. So in terms of civil rights, it's weird because he's active, and there's a couple moments in particular where he's active in it. But
he's a millionaire at this point.
He's a millionaire.
He has made millions of dollars. He flies around in a private plane at this point. So the rest of Black America is like, we want rights. We want, you know, better working conditions. All these things.
Right.
And he's like, yeah, I'm going to fly in on my fucking plane.
And he's got
and he's a self-made man.
He's a self-made man who sees his journey as the ultimate symbol of what needs to happen, right? Black empowerment, which is why it kind of makes sense. So he supports a bunch of different political figures over the course of his life.
Yeah.
And he rides the gamut in terms of like, so loves JFK.
Yes.
And Bobby Kennedy, you know, both of those guys he'll like talk about in later interviews about how they were, you know, great. And then he supports Hubert Humphrey in the 1968 election against Richard Nixon. But 4 years later, when Richard Nixon runs for re-election, he famously supports Nixon in 1972. I'm jumping over a few civil rights stuff, but
well, we can go back to those. But you're right, but that I think goes back to what I was saying about he's just always vying for the top, like. Obviously, everybody has their own like beliefs and opinions on stuff, but I feel like his drive is to do whatever is going to get him there. So if he needs to be around civil rights, Black Power, liberal things, he'll do that. And then if he needs to swing the other way, he'll go that way too.
He also writes a song because a lot of Black leaders and a lot of just like liberal thinkers, obviously in general, were against the war in Vietnam, particularly once you get to the late 60s. He writes a song sort of supporting the troops and performs for the troops, which again is like a very pro-establishment type thing. Going into some of his civil rights thing, his big cause, and this is kind of true throughout his life, is education, is like Black education. He writes a song about Don't Be a Dropout. And then throughout his life, actually in his will, he was going to donate a lot to you know, a foundation that he founded for education. And that kind of falls into his general idea. And I think this kind of helps explain why he supported Nixon, which is like, pull yourself up by your bootstraps type thing.
He was preaching a lot, and they talk about it in the movie. There's even quotes of him on tape doing it where he's like, Black America shouldn't be taking handouts. We need to be working for ourselves. Very, very on that independent shit. Because again, he figured it out.
Right.
So he's like, why can't everybody else figure it out?
He's got a lot of that. And it's like, and I think that it's in the documentary where they make the clear counterpoint to that, which is, you're the most talented person ever.
right.
Yeah, so like, there is something different about
it's
you.
It's not an apples to apples comparison.
You're literally gliding across the stage. Also, you were gifted. I mean, yeah, I don't know if you call this a gift or whatever, with the greatest work ethic ever. I mean, the guy was performing over 320 shows a year.
Yeah.
And that is kind of, I mean, yes, it's hard work, but like, hard work is kind of a gift too. I mean, if you're able to do it.
Yeah. Listen, you need to be motivated by something that is beyond, like, I believe this for James Brown. I believe this for Jeff Bezos, right? Think about it. You hear, what do people say all the time? Well, once you make a certain amount of money, what's the point of working? Because the money isn't the thing. It's they want status. They want power. They want recognition. They want to be, I don't know, a colossal figure in society in some way. And it's not about the money.
And he accomplishes this for sure, and it's probably most evident the night after Martin Luther King Jr. dies. And we should say that, like, he respected the hell out of MLK, but they didn't see eye to eye on a lot of things.
No, but MLK also respected him, because there was that quote where, what was that thing in D.C.? There was some speech or something going on, and James Brown showed up and performed. And
yes.
Martin Luther King is at this meeting for a social rights planning thing that they were doing. And he famously was like, well, I don't know what you guys are doing, but I'm leaving to go catch James Brown perform. And he leaves this like in civil rights meeting with like big leaders of the civil rights movement to go watch James Brown do this performance that really like unified and got a lot of people, I guess, excited for.
I believe, I'm not sure if it was the same thing, but in 1966, civil rights activist James Meredith was preparing something called the March Against Fear in Mississippi, and Brown went to march or perform there.
I think that's what I'm
talking about. After Meredith was shot. Yeah.
And Martin Luther King attended that to watch that.
Yes.
So that's what I'm thinking of.
So Martin Luther King dies April 4th, 1968. And on that night and the night after, there are riots and just like a complete chaos and uproar throughout every major city in the country. So James Brown is scheduled to perform in Boston that night.
Yeah.
And there's the mayor's instinct is to cancel the performance. And he's advised not to by, I forgot the name of the guy, but he's advised and eventually convinced not to.
Yes. To not perform.
Oh, no, sorry. He's advised, the mayor is advised and eventually agrees to let James Brown perform.
Yes.
With the added twist that they're going to broadcast it for free, and therefore maybe people will have an incentive to stay home.
Right.
And not be out on the streets that night. The one catch there is that James Brown is now going to lose a ton of money off of the performance because people are going to ask for their money back for buying tickets once they know that they could just watch at home from TV. So Brown's pissed. He's willing to, you know, help keep the peace or whatever, but he wants his money.
I don't remember that part. Yeah. That's fucking crazy. Yeah.
So they work out.
Dude, that's the difference between him and I'll lump you in that. That's the difference between him and us because we're fucking desperate comics, right? If you said to me, yeah, you're going to do a set in Boston, but we're going to broadcast it because we think, Chris, your set is going to help keep the peace on riots. I'd be like, yeah, do it. My brain wouldn't be like, well, where's my royalty rights?
Oh, no.
The people bought like all the. No.
I would go the opposite way. I'll pay you. That sounds great. They don't even have to tell me anything.
Can I get a copy of it? Yeah. Are you taping it?
Wait, did you just say I'm going to be on television? Yeah. Sounds good.
Dude.
So they work out a deal for tens of thousands of dollars to compensate for Brown. And this is all being done, by the way, within 24 hours. I mean, it's got to be done really quickly. Brown performs, and almost every other major American city does have, you know, a completely chaotic night. Boston, I think, actually recorded less crime that night than a typical Friday night. And it's largely credited to James Brown's performance. During his performance, at some point, audience members start going on stage, and the police officers, white police officers, start beating back these black audience members. And there's a moment where Brown tells the police officers to back off and then gives like a brief speech.
Yes, and lets the kids, right, lets them, well, he lets them come up and then very in smoothly, like, fucking tells them to go back.
Yes.
He, like, kind of is like, okay, you've had your fun now.
Yeah.
Go back. He kind of says some other funny shit, too. He's like, you're making us look bad.
He's like, yeah, he's like, you're making us look bad. I want to get respect for my people. But probably the best moment ever, and I think that, like, a comedian can relate to this, is after this insane event, he's just like, one, two, three. Yeah. it's like, wait, how did your performance recover from this? It's wild.
Oh, my God, dude.
We should also say some of the spectacle when it comes to his performance in general. He was influenced by Gorgeous George, the wrestler.
That's why he did the cape for Please, Please, Please.
The cape. The cape is unbelievable, where it's basically Please, Please, Please was the song that he would do it for. He would sing himself into exhaustion and then collapse.
Right.
And then
one of the backup singers would come over to console him, and then the cape guy would come out,
drench a cape on top of him, and like the Phoenix,
try to escort him off stage. But in the, you know, in the, he's basically doing a live music video for every time he performs that song, because he starts leaving and he's sad. You know, he looks, even the footage of him, he does look like he's having like a fucking breakdown.
Yeah, like a,
and then he runs back to the mic, you know, don't leave me. And it's this idea that he's so heartbroken, but he can't not keep singing about it. And his friends are like, come on, man, you're better than that.
It's such a spectacle. I mean, the guy's just like, just such an entertainer.
But even going back to what we were talking about earlier, like with Please, Please, Please being a song that wasn't common because he's just saying the same word pretty much the entire time. They talked about in the doc, nobody had seen anybody do a performance like that before, really. And so people actually thought that he was like a lunatic.
Right, right.
Like local news would be like, James Brown losing his mind, having a full-blown breakdown on stage, like not knowing that this is planned.
Yes. Fast forward 20 years and he actually is not putting on an act goes on interviews and stuff. One more thing with civil rights that's got to be mentioned is the same year that Martin Luther King dies a few months later, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, which becomes an anthem for the, well, partly the Black Power movement, but also just the civil rights movement in general.
Right.
He kind of distances himself from the song. He doesn't like play it in concerts very often afterwards.
Right.
And years later would say, like, we don't need that song anymore. But it's still a very influential song. It was directed both obviously at racism, but also at like colorism, of like the idea of lighter skinned blacks discriminating against darker skinned blacks. So it's like our color gives us, you know, we have pride in our in blackness.
I didn't know that he double backed on the song like that.
A little bit, yeah.
I mean, it kind of makes sense. I mean, I could see his thinking even going somewhere to the level of like, well, this doesn't help cultivate the white audience that I've now gained.
Yeah, so he loses white audience from that, loses black audience from supporting Nixon.
Right.
So he's, you know, I mean, he's whether
he's a real
you believe-
Candace Owens of music.
He's Kanye.
Yeah, he's Kanye. He is the original Kanye.
But whether you believe in the stuff that he supported or not, he definitely is someone who's willing to just kind of, you know, go with his gut.
All the while crushing music.
Yeah.
Like that's the reason why it's like, not that, well, I mean, look, you could join up with whatever political affiliation you want. I mean, I guess really the drug abuse isn't good for him and the domestic violence is bad and not paying your band members. But outside of those things, it's like, you're almost just like, who cares? The music's so again, to your point, Kanye, it's very Kanye.
All right, so let's get into some of the more crazy aspects of his life. First of all, there's a 8-part podcast by CNN called The Mystery of James Brown, which is all about the mysterious circumstances of his death and of the death of his third wife, Adrian, and That's a big thing.
That's the only part of his life that I know literally nothing about.
So I'll give you a kind of like some of the information from that podcast, and then obviously listen to the podcast if you're, you know, if your appetite is whetted by what I'm saying. So there's a few sort of theories that come after that, and obviously it's one of those podcasts that probably raises more questions than it answers, kind of thing,
right?
But there are suspicions that his third wife was murdered, Adrian, who was one of the wives who had many, many domestic violence accusations towards him, and then would take it back and then would say it again. Also, in 1988, we should mention that he was arrested on drug charges. Well, was arrested on drug charges and assaulting his wife, but then he went with a gun into like an insurance seminar, and it resulted in a police chase where he would resist arrest. And for that, he went to jail for over 2 years and was eventually paroled. So his dealings with the law. Oh, also the IRS was after him for decades.
Nobody. Yeah, he wasn't paying anybody.
So what this podcast essentially suggests is that there was a thing called the James Brown quote unquote machine, and that it was kind of a huge network of politicians and gangsters and government organizations that James Brown was like both in control of and controlled by, and that Adrian, maybe by Brown's representatives or someone in this machine, was murdered because of all the accusations she was throwing at James Brown.
Right.
Then it gets into maybe James Brown was killed. The theory there, or at least the motive there, would be that his lawyer, Buddy Dallas, and his accountant were controlling him and his estate and eventually, you know, his will, and that Brown wanted to sort of move to New York and free himself of them. And when they realized that this was the case, they arranged for his death. On the record reason for his death, by the way, he died in 2006, it was heart failure, that he had like a pneumonia or something like that.
Right.
He died from congestive heart failure. But there's like a million, I don't want to say conspiracy theories, because I think that they do have some weight. So the biggest proof, by the way, that maybe there was foul play is that the doctor himself, who was overseeing him, said that he thought that there was foul play and that an autopsy should be done. And no autopsy was done.
Damn. That's... He really is like, love him or hate him, it's such like a wild... I didn't see the movie.
I didn't see it either. Yeah,
like the Chadwick Boseman. Yeah. Because I normally don't like biopics, and yeah. I love James Brown, and I didn't want to...
Yeah, sure.
Hate him because of that.
Yeah.
And I also didn't think that they were going to get into the nitty-gritty of anything.
Right.
So... But, like, what a fucking, like, story. It's, like, a little bit of that, like, kind of Tony Montana kind of thing. It's just, like, rise to the top. And then at the end, it all starts falling apart. And now you're getting roped up with the mob and, like, other weird ways to try to make money and keep a career alive.
Dude, it's everything. And then there are other things that this podcast touches on. So the reason why the podcast even begins, there was this circus singer who had collaborated. Her name is Jackie Hollander, who collaborated with Brown in the 80s, and she calls up the reporter for CNN, Thomas Lake, and says that she has reason to believe that Brown was murdered and that Adrian was murdered. The story there goes that she accused Brown of raping her in the 80s, and through this guy Lake's research and his interviews with Jackie, you get into this whole thing of the machine and everything. That's the other tangent is Brown's possible association with the CIA. And again, it's one of those things where like he thinks that they were tapping him, which is possible.
Right.
The reason for that goes back to the Martin Luther King assassination, where essentially politicians were like, possibly, this guy has so much power to stop a riot.
Right.
He probably also has the power to start one.
Right.
So there's theories there that maybe the CIA was like involved in trying to get him.
Wasn't John Lennon on that list?
Lennon for sure. And Lennon was a similar thing. So Lennon, they tried to get him on immigration. And it seems like Brown maybe was more IRS stuff.
Right.
In any case, there's like so much.
Interesting.
There's so many theories surrounding this guy. And if you want to hear more about these kind of crazy ideas, then the James Brown mystery on CNN, you know, covers it in 8 parts.
There's later this year, there's a 4-part documentary series coming out produced by Mick Jagger about James Brown.
That's going to be amazing.
Yeah. I'm hoping they go in depth and give us everything we need to know to fill in the gaps.
Well, it's one of those things where it's like, and when we're talking about it, yeah, all that stuff's interesting, the CIA, and of course you got to mention the negative stuff, but like what you want to be talking about is him as the greatest performer of the 20th century.
That's all I ever think about when I think of him anyway. I don't, the only ironic, hilarious thing that I think of when I think of him, and one of my favorite songs by him, I don't even, it definitely came out later in his career. Did you ever listen to the song King Heroin?
Yes.
I fucking love that song. I know every word to that song. And that's the only thing that's funny to me is like the irony of that song. But even still, it's a great song.
So it's basically a song of him, you know, telling people to not use drugs.
Right.
And Angel Dust seemed to be the drug that really got him. Mm-hmm. Later on, there's a crazy interview.
Oh, I've seen it. Yeah, where he's sweating with the glasses and he's got the...
And yeah, where he's, after he's been accused again of beating Adrian, where he's just like clearly on something, but I think it's Angel Dust. I think it's PCP.
Yeah.
But that leads into your, okay, so your association with Brown, your love of James Brown, how did that start? Do you remember?
Yes, one of my favorite movies of all time, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
Guy Ritchie.
On the soundtrack is the song The Payback.
Okay.
I had obviously heard of James Brown before, but never like sat down and like listened to James Brown. And I love that soundtrack, and I'm obsessed with that movie, and I got the soundtrack to the movie. So then I was like, oh, well, if this song is so good, because I loved that song, what are the other songs like?
Right.
And I was like... he was one of the artists that I was in like high school, probably like senior year of high school going into college, around when I like really started listening to it. And I was like, my whole world changed. Just, you know, when you like discover, I don't know how into music you are, but like when you discover a new artist and you're like, everything I thought I knew is not what I thought I knew. It's all different now.
That was like with me and the Bee Gees.
You son of a bitch.
Sorry, yes, continue.
But no, yeah. It just like changed everything. And it was like, I mean, my favorite stuff is the stuff he did later with Bootsy Collins, but I still love the old shit, like the Try Me and Please, Please, Please and all that stuff. But I don't know. It's just, he's just one of my favorite artists. He's one of my favorite artists of all time. He's not my number one. However, and this is one of the reasons I picked him, is, you know, when people say, oh, if you could only listen to one artist for the rest of your life, I, without a doubt, without any second thought in my mind, will pick James Brown for 2 reasons. One, he has a massive discography. Mm-hmm. Massive. Anybody who's like, even if you picked like someone's like Beyonce, it's like, what does she got, 5 albums? You're gonna be on an island with 5 albums. That's all you got? Like, you might like them a lot, but you're stuck with 5 albums.
Yeah, you're hanging yourself from a coconut tree after. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's got, I don't even know how many fucking albums he has.
Right.
It's endless, and he covers a wide array of genres. So you have diversity and depth with him. Whereas, like, my favorite artist of all time, I think, is John Lee Hooker, like, a blues artist. But, like, again, now I'm just stuck with Delta Blues for the rest of my life on an island.
Right.
I'd rather have the hardest working man in fucking show business. I'd rather have that collection.
I think the other thing with him, other than the music, is just, I think anyone who... I don't even want to say anyone who entertain. I think even like anyone who gets in front of people, it could be a professor or whatever.
Right.
When you see someone empty the tank like that.
Yes.
It's just, or maybe it's not even exclusive to entertainment. It's just like, I mean, I know from stand-up, and I'm far from a physical, super, super electric performer, but you've got to be present. You got to try and all that stuff. And sometimes it's hard. Like sometimes it's really, really hard to put in 100%, especially when you're not in the best mood or, whatever. This guy just was a machine. I mean, like, just a total machine.
He, everything in his life all boiled down to those times, that every time he was on stage or on a microphone. Yeah, to your point, to watch or listen to a man or a person just, no matter what they're doing, give you their all while they're doing it. And if he wasn't, he did a great job faking it.
Yeah. No, right. If you saw James Brown performance and he came off being like, I wasn't giving it 100, you'd be like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to mention this, this seems like an appropriate time to mention it. One of my favorite things to find out, which I knew that he fined his bands, like the band members. Right. And, they talked about how he wanted such perfection that he made the band members wear suits on the bus. That they were on tour like 300 days out of the year or something. And they got to a point he made us wear suits on the bus because he said that we had to be ready at all times, that you never know. And so they talk about where he'd be on stage and the band members say that in a normal band, sometimes you're looking at the guitarist, sometimes you're looking at the drummer to see. He said, when you play in James Brown, you're watching James Brown. And when you watch the footage, you see all of them. He walks this way, they all look that way. If he walks this way, they're all looking that way. And he said, you had to be ready because if he decided to stop the song or do a hit or make you do a solo, you had to be ready to do it. And there's a part with Maceo, he's like, man, he would find you out. He would find you out. If you messed up, he'd pick you out. And he would do this. He would flip, for people listening, he would take his hand, he'd flick his hand out, like all five fingers, and snap it back. And it looks like a dance move.
Right.
And he's dancing, and when he'd find you out, if you were off a little bit or anything, flash his hand one time, $25 fine. Flash his hand two times, $50 fine. Flash his hand three times, that's $75. So, and then they show footage of him dancing, and he turns and looks at the band. And if you don't know that James Brown's doing it when you're watching it, you just think he's dancing.
Yeah.
But when you know and you see him doing it, it's like one, two, three. It's like someone just got fined, and he directed it at them.
It's the toughest boss ever.
Because it's the toughest boss because you're still entertaining.
Right.
You're still in the middle of the performance.
You're getting fined as you're performing.
You're in the middle of playing with one of the most elite group of musicians ever, with one of the most crazy OCD fucking narcissist singers ever. And you have to get better while you're actively getting a fine.
Yeah.
And know it.
That's got to be the story that I loved was, I think it was it might have been a drummer, but I'm not exactly sure. But they're in the studio and Brown goes up to correct what he's doing. And the guy's like, yeah, all right. And then plays the exact same thing. And Brown's like, yep, you got it. You took my advice.
Yeah. I think that was Fred who said it. Yeah, because that's what's right. And that's the other thing that's crazy about him, too. James Brown wouldn't be anything without the band, but the band also wouldn't be anything without James Brown. It's a very yin-yang relationship, but that James Brown doesn't know anything about playing music.
Oh, he doesn't know. He certainly doesn't know like how to read music or anything like that. Yeah, no, totally self-taught.
Amazing singer.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if he mentioned, but they said I read that he's used to be a Little Richard impersonator, which is how he learned how to scream.
By the way, I also did an episode on John Lennon. Little Richard shows up in terms of influence
everywhere. Yeah.
And his career was temporarily cut short a little bit because he became religious, but in terms of influence, that guy is like towards the very top.
Huge.
And when he died a few years ago, it was like, yeah, he got a big obituary and all this stuff, but I feel like it's not fully appreciated.
No, not at all. His generation was so like different. Like people don't even know.
Yeah.
I bet a lot of 20-something-year-olds don't even know who the fuck James Brown is now.
No.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So James Brown doesn't know how to play music. Everybody else around him are like some of the best musicians ever. And that same story, when he describes it, he says that James Brown would just come up to him and be like, you're doing the horns like this, din, 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 but I need you to do the horns like, din, 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 din. And then that's how he's explaining it to him.
Right.
There's no like, hey, can you change the note here? And it's just, It's a
primal,
rambling, primal, rambling man who knows what he wants to hear, but doesn't have the fucking
tools to
like articulate what he needs.
Yeah. I mean, and it's true for so many of popular musicians of the era where they're self-taught. I mean, they're doing it by feel.
That's how I mean, I mentioned earlier, that's one of the things I love about the Delta Blues guys, because like they break down how those guys play guitar, and you could be the most technically trained guitar player in the world, but you can't play real Delta Blues like the way, like anybody can play like a, you know, that like,
sure.
But when you listen to a Delta Blues artist play that same thing, their sounds 100 times better because they learned these techniques by watching and being mentored. Like Robert Johnson was mentored by somebody. Somebody else got mentored by Robert Johnson. Right. And it's like it gets passed down.
Yeah.
Versus, yeah, just learn, go to the Delta Blues music school and learn how to play that.
And like, then there's also the aspect of it where, and this is what James Brown in an interview was asked to define soul music. And he says that there is something about, you know, just being black where it's like, it's going to, because of the history, because of the oppression, all the stuff, it's just, it's going to come out different.
Yeah.
It's going to come out stronger. Yeah.
Always.
All right, man. Well, Chris Metcalf on Give Me a Name.
I'm thinking, I'm wondering what audience people listening, are they be like, where did we end there?
Oh, why did we end there?
Like, I'm not mad about it, but like it's just, and it's just so funny because like, because I was,
I don't know how to end these things. Yeah, what do you want from me?
Well, it's just so funny because there's just like, I feel like we could end up doing like a 3-hour thing of just throwing around James Brown stories and isms and like, yeah, all this type of shit. So yeah, no, that's, it's fine. It's just funny to be,
I'm
like,
just
where
gonna
do
make,
you even end it?
No, I'm gonna make a comment, just a very somber comment about the history of oppression of African Americans, and be like, well, that's a good place.
I know, yeah.
Let's leave it there.
Whites can't sing soul.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you so much for being on,
dude. Thanks for having me on.